Fred Durst?
He's like Iggy.
Oh, you are sorely mistaken. I
play something from $3 Bill, y'all.
What is that?
That's the landmark Limp Bizkit album.
Limp Bizkit? Oh, my God. I mean, they...
Wait, you don't agree that those are the most crucial grooves you've heard since Funkadelic?
What, Limp Bizkit grooves? Yeah, absolutely.
It's like the ultimate cross between Funkadelic and Rob Tyner.
Yeah, no, I don't agree at all.
Oh, you do not deserve a radio show.
CITR 101.9 FM, your crucial groove station.
It's just a lot of BS. A whole lot of BS. It's just a lot of BS. A whole lot of BS.
Hello, this is CITR 101.9 FM, UBC. It's David Usher speaking. This is my first time at UBC, first time doing radio here, and I should say a little bit about myself before we start. I'm not the youngest student here in the university. I'm 81 years old, and course, it's free after 65. And I'm an MD and PhD in the past, which means I've done a lot of medicine, a lot of research. But that's a long time ago, too. And I have five grandchildren and also been married five times. So these kids come from myself, but they also come from different mothers. That's all right. I want to start off with a poem, not my poem, though I write lots of poems and sing lots of songs. I want to start off a poem by Jane Kenyon. I don't know how many listening know of Jane Kenyon. I think she's possibly one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. At least that's, maybe I'm biased, I don't know. She comes from Maine. I don't know if any of you know the state of Maine. It's the far east of the country. A very different kind of people there. A lot of them live and do farming, little farmyards. And in a sense, that's what this poem's all about. It's also about Jane. She is suffering from a disease, I think it's either ALS or similar. Like, over the years, it will cause more and more muscle weakness. And eventually, the question is, what will happen to her then? And when she's not strong enough. The poem is called Otherwise. I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birch wood all morning. I did the work I love. At noon, I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I stepped in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls, and I planned another day just like this day. But one day, I know it will be otherwise. The next is a song, quite different. A song by Joe Southey. I belong to a choir, the A Cappello Laboratory Choir. And we sang this song at one of our concerts. It's called Walk a Mile in My Shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Before you accuse, criticize, and abuse. Walk a mile in my shoes. If I could be you, if you could be me, for just 1 hour, if we could find a way to get inside each other's mind, if we could see each other in all our separate beauty, we'd be surprised at the times we'd been unkind. Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes before you abuse, criticize, and accuse. Walk a mile in my shoes. Now the whole world you see around you is just a reflection of the law that says you're going to reap just what you sow. So unless you've lived a life of total perfection, you'd better be careful of every stone that you throw. Sometimes it's easy to be hard and accusing. Sometimes you just don't know we're holding on to pain. Well, there's a lot of love out there that we're refusing, and there's a lot to learn and awful lot to gain. Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes before you abuse, criticize, and accuse. Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes before you abuse, criticize, and accuse. Walk a mile in my shoes. The next thing I'm doing is quite different. It's called Normal Family. I did this on stage at Cafe, Cafe de Surrey or something, a commercial. And we all supposed to do what we wanted to do, anything. Didn't matter what it was. I did this thing called Normal Family. I don't exactly know why, but everybody was cheery at the end of it, like it was something wild, wild, wild. Well, it's just called Normal Family. By the way, it has some swear words in it. I hope you don't mind. What is that? Normal? Normal? What's that? Define a little bit. Tell me a normal family. Describe. Okay. Heterosexual. Mom and dad. Maybe grandma, grandpa. And kids. Small ones or bigger. What about gay families, mister? What about blended? In the juicer. What about that? What about communal group families? What about transgender, transsexual, all that complicated stuff? What about all of them? What about all of them, mister? Oh, gay? Gay families. Lesbian couples. Maybe together for 50 years or so. Possibly. Do they fuck each other? If they wish to. Or hold hands. Cuddle together. Maria is 80. Charmaine, 75. 50 years together. Any kids? No, but yes. A lot of kids, for example. Also big people, friends, other lovers, parties too. And they love each other? Yes. Half a century. Yeah. Half a century long. Well, they mostly do love each other. Sometimes they fight. Maria's Irish. Charmaine is French. Sometimes they may scratch each other. But I made this up. They do not exist. What about gays and lesbians and transgenders? Do they have normal managers? Sometimes. Is This next poem I need to explain a little bit ahead of time. It's called Cohen, Sandy, and Me. It's kind of, you might say, quite autobiographical, sort of. I did know Leonard Cohen a long time ago when I was 17 and he was 16 at a party my cousin gave, good friend of Lenny's then, a party he gave in Montreal, of course, where I was born. It was a while ago. Sitting in the parking area outside the veterinarians, howling in misery, Sandy, precious, golden, surviving the steep hills of Israel, now cancerous, to be put to sleep. Oh my God, they'll kill him! And I cried some more. Then put a disc to listen to. So long, Marianne. It's time we began to laugh and cry, to laugh and laugh about it all again. Ages back, a party at Cousins, Lenny 16, I 17, long time ago. Today the song plays on YouTube. Cohen at his beatific reaching. What to do next? More YouTube? There are thousands of songs. Do they all say goodbye? Tuesday to the Chelsea Hotel. Only an illusion at the Fire Hall. Cohen in dance, theater, music. I once traversed the original place, Chelsea Hotel, Manhattan, in 1959, or was it 1960? This is a somewhat different kind of poem, which I wrote, of course. I write a lot of poems. I'm not sure what you'll think of it. The poem is called Whither Thou Goest, I Shall Go. It was written at 1 a.m., 1999, in an October morn. Whither thou goest, I shall go. Watching ice climbing movies on WTN, typing this poem. Just talked for 2 hours with Jean. Meet her? Soon to be. We don't know each other hardly. She knows I'm a Jew, as I she's Irish, Scotch. Verily, what's to do? Where are we from? Our nationality, religion, birthplace, relief systems, belief systems, trust, and antitrust. What is all of this? Am I dreaming? I think not. I am still awake, ready to go, just about anywhere. With who? Don't know yet. Now, a bit more music. Figure out where it goes here. The yellow. Go back to words since I can't quite figure out how to operate the CD thing. I'm still new to UBC CITR 101.9 FM. Previously, I was doing it at UNBC, which is kind of what you call it, small potatoes. It's just a little school, 5,000 students. What the hell? Next one is quite a different one. I mentioned I've been married 5 times. I think I did say that. And only with the last one, the fifth one. We've been together for 2.5 years, almost exactly 2.5 years. And I suppose you could say we're just getting started. But there's a long, long way to go because, well, I should give some history on this one before I read this. This is not actually a very nice poem. It happened near the beginning. It happened 2.5 years ago. You see, we're both disabled. Hard to admit that, but we met each other in what's called the Open Door Group for Disabled People. And not long after we met, which was January 2012, 2.5 years ago, not long after that, we split up. At least as far as I knew, we split up. At least I thought we split up. Only about, well, I went to Europe to visit friends and family. And just like that, I was gone. But before I left, even though we looked like we'd split up for sure, she gave me a little package, a little tiny package, and said, "Don't open it." And she said, "Don't open it until you get to your friend's place." Well, I knew that was a woman named Irma, who I met her in, you know, community pools, community hot tubs. And that was the way I got to know her from then. That's about all we'd done is talk and be in pools together. But I think for Lynn, Lynn assumed we were lovers, Irma and I, which is not true. Here's what I wrote. It's called Lynn Thoughts. "It is unfortunate what you did. Out of the purity of your heart of hearts, you bought me a gift, sterling silver. But it was a secret. Would not tell me what it was, except that it was a going-away gift. That was unfortunate what you did, so pure of heart. Lynn, is that what you wish? To drive me into utter madness? Is that it? For I now understand why you purchased this quite expensive little thing. It'll have to be something to wear on my person. Isn't that correct, Lynn? Has to be visible. Has to be visible when I alight from the airplane. You know quite exactly who I shall greet with a great big hug. And that person will say, 'What a beautiful thing you wear.' It could be a sterling silver bracelet, a sterling silver ring for my finger, a sterling silver necklace, whatever. As long as it was quite visible for Irma to see. As if you owe me, as if we are quite obviously together, as if but you do not owe me. We are not together. Maybe that's it. You hope to drive me into madness, to mental hospital, then come and visit every day without fail. Lynn, I cannot forgive you for what you have done." Well, continue that story. First of all, we're very much together. We're more in love now than we've ever been 2.5 years later. Though we don't sleep together, we live separately. We're not even common law, though we wear a ring each. Same matching rings, like wedding rings, but we're not wedded. We're not married. We're illegally common law because we live separately, which works out well. We're still very much in love, or more in love now than we've ever been before. But at that time, I was all mixed up. Because when I opened the package, I couldn't wait. I didn't wait until I saw Irma. I opened it up in the airport, the Vancouver airport. And what was in it? Well, it wasn't what I thought. There were two little lead things that attached. One's talus that religious Jew can wear, has to wear in the synagogue. And I came from an Orthodox family, Orthodox Jewish family. These little lead things that you could wear, that's what it was. In other words, it wasn't what I thought it was. That kind of thing happens a lot in life, you know. You could say, you could almost say it's the way it is. And not just my life, but people's life, nations' life even. Nations make mistakes sometimes. And they go to war. Right now, well, start with, I lived in Israel doing research on marijuana, and it's supposed to be something different on methylmercury, but the guy I was supposed to work with was somehow in England at the time. I ended up being said I'm going to be working on marijuana, and or actually on THC, but that was a long time ago, 1970 and 71. I was only there for less than a year. Lynn was Israel at the same time, but I can't really go into this without permission, and she's not sitting beside me. And, you know, CITRs, maybe next time I'll talk more about that one. But she was in Israel at the same time, but much younger than me. I call Lynn my spring chicken. She's only 64 and I'm 81. When she was there, she was, I think, just 20, 21 years old. It was a long time ago. So keep mentioning, by the way, the station. It's CITR 101.9 FM, UBC. This next poem is very hard to understand, although I think I'm beginning to understand it. It's actually just the last verse of a poem by Dylan Thomas. This guy was... Well, he was a drunkard, he was a terrific alcoholic. He liked to drink. Why shouldn't he? He was Welsh. Well, I can't say that everybody in Wales drinks, but a lot of them drink, who do drink, drink heavily. And he certainly did, and it helped his poetry. I mean, he wrote amazing poems. He wasn't very religious. I couldn't say he wasn't religious at all. He was anti-religious, very much anti-religious. And the idea of altars and doing vows before altars, remember he was originally brought up, I think he was brought up as a Catholic or something like that, maybe Anglican, which is the same idea, Anglican, Catholic, whatever. And he not just hated it, it was vicious hatred. And this last verse of the poem called Altar Wise by Owlite by Dylan Thomas. What is the meter of a dictionary? The size of Genesis, the short sparks gender. Shade without shape, the shape of the Pharaoh's echo. My shape of age, nagging the wounded whisper. Which sticks of wind blew out the burning gentry? Questions are hunchbacks to the porker marrow. What of a bamboo man among your acres? Corset the boneyards for a crooked boy. Button your bodice on a hump of splinters. My camel's eyes will needle through the shroud. Lover's reflection of the mushroom features still snap by night in the bread-sided field. Once close up, smotting in the wall of pictures are clamped, thrown back upon the cutting flood. This next one, it's rather, I could say, extreme autobiographical, but more about my son, at that point, future daughter-in-law. Certainly my daughter-in-law, one of my daughters-in-law, I have three of them, and wonderful, oh, wonderful ladies. But I decided to write a wedding poem. They were married in Australia. Rach is Australian from Perth. Josh, well, my son was born in Vancouver, matter of fact. And it's a long ways apart, but he met Rachel. He likes to be called Rach. He met Rachel in Perth. I don't think she was from Perth. She was from Adelaide, but, you know, Australia. But she was doing a course, and he was doing a course, a summer course. And that's where they met. This is a wedding poem, which I read, standing on a bunch of rocks on a beach somewhere in South Australia. Rachel and Josh. Rachel, a lady from Adelaide, left her beginnings and some well in her past, traveled far to Perth to further her schooling. What about Josh for a wedding as two people? Josh, conceived on Hornby Island, British Columbia, nearly born on a wild winter storm, finally gave his first cry at Comox Hospital. By utmost coincidence, 31 years later, Josh was also in Perth. Did the gods decide their meeting? Did they speak the same language? Yes, they did. Not Australian or Canadian, or a mixture. No, boys and girls, and grown-ups too. Their words were symbols coming from their knowledge of loving ideas to a world so needy. That is how they spoke. And I'm not exaggerating the end of it. In fact, it seems like all my children, and I include by that all the girls and the boys, all my sons and daughters and all the girls and the boys, the men and the women, it seems like all they're interested in doing is trying to save the whole fucking world. Excuse the swear word, but at times I get a bit irritable about the fact that the world doesn't, most of the time it seems like most of the world, almost all the world, doesn't listen, doesn't care, whatever happens to any of them. I haven't told you about one particular part of my family, Bruce. Later I'll mention Eric, because both of them come from a different mother than Josh did, but they're very close, all three of them. And wonderful, wonderful, wonderful wives and mothers they are, as they are fathers and very much fathers and daddies. Bruce was born almost exactly half a century back, 50 years ago, God, I remember him when he was not quite born. This is Montreal where I was born. I was born 81 years ago, though. But 50 years ago, in those days, nobody was allowed in the labor room or delivery room except, you know, the nurses and the obstetrician. That was all. I mean, the fact that I, 50 years ago, I was a doctor, it doesn't matter. Nobody came to the labor room except what I told you. Like the obstetrician was, you know, he was king shit, put it mildly. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was pretty tired, trying to keep myself awake, knowing that a baby was being born, and it would be, I think I knew it would be my son. I'm not sure I knew that at that point, because before ultrasound, I think. Anyway, a baby was being born. I didn't know. I didn't even know then. Didn't know anything. And then that's right, because he came out at 3 in the morning. The obstetrician came out and said, "It's a boy." At 3, the first time I did know that. Now I remember. 50 years ago. Much sooner than that. It was September, I think it was September 29th. It was, no, September 9th, I think. It was the 11th month. Yeah. It was 9/11. It's now called 9/11. Bruce had an instinct. He knew when to buy and when to sell. He was a business person. Got his MBA at Harvard. A business person. When to buy, when to sell. Well, everybody, I mean, obviously every business person knows when to buy, when to sell, but the trouble is, at least half the time, sometimes more than half the time, they're wrong. And therefore, it's tricky to trust them all the time. I mean, not any of the time. Bruce always knew. I think it's some kind of thing inside his brain. He just knew and knew. Didn't think about it. He wasn't actually very interested in money. He was very interested in the world, in the whole bloody world. And 9/11, if he hadn't been quite sick and at home with both Naomi, his wife, wonderful, fantastic wife, Naomi, if he hadn't been with Naomi and his two small children then, a while ago, Theo was only 7 weeks old, and Benjamin was not quite two. They heard a bang, all of them, a huge bang like an earthquake, a very big bang. And they didn't know what it was because of all the money they'd been pouring in. They owned a penthouse, the seventh floor of a small building, but they had the penthouse. Naomi, she, with Theo in a, you know, on her tummy, tied little thing, went up the blue staircase, just a few steps, but steep, to open the top and look outside. And she saw the second plane hit the tower! The second plane hit the second tower. She came down and said, "Bruce, we're at war. War!" They quickly got a couple of things. They were on near between 5th and 6th Avenue. I think they were around 13th Street or whatever. I can't remember. But I got all this told to me later. I knew where they were living. I'd been there before. And they ran up 5th Avenue. Bruce was holding little Benjamin. And Naomi had baby Theo. And they only brought a bottle and a diaper with them. and made a couple of quick phone calls before they left. They knew I didn't have a phone yet. I just moved into school in Prince George, UNBC, and I got settled in. Bruce didn't bother trying to phone me because he knew I didn't have a phone at that time. So they phoned Mom, and the line was busy. So in desperation, in a matter of sort of seconds, Bruce phoned Eric. I haven't told you about Eric yet. Get to it. My children, I could say, imagine all six of them, because I count both the boys and girls, the girls and boys, as if they're, you know, as if I gave birth to them all. I didn't give birth to any of them. But anyway, Bruce, I remember either Eric told me afterwards, my middle son is now 48. Not quite 48 in August. But anyway, he's in Paris, not Paris now, he's back. Now he's in Stockholm. But what I gather, as they ran up Fifth Avenue with all the ash raining down on them, all that ash, Bruce said out loud to Naomi, "In no way do I ever want to do any more banking." And true to his words, he never did banking after that. He did things like banking, but it was not the same thing. What he did do, not much later, he went to Columbia. I don't know how many of you know about Columbia University. Columbia, a very famous university in Manhattan. Very famous. Quite, in those days, quite conservative in 2001. I should have mentioned 2001. I think most people know 9/11 was then. But he asked them, he said, "I'd like to teach." And I mean, he was brand new. Nobody knew him at all at Columbia. And they said, "What do you want to teach?" He said, "I'd like to teach finance." And actually, eco-finance. Well, they said, "Finance, we know a bit about that, Columbia, don't we?" "Yeah, in Columbia University." What's your background?" "Well," we said, "I did my MBA at Harvard, and I was 9/11. I was sick, otherwise, for sure, I wouldn't be here." And he said, "Also Lehman Brothers. Then all of a sudden they got very interested and said, "Okay, that's finance. What's this eco stuff? What's that?" And he looked at them and said, I have a brother. This is Eric. For Eric, eco meant a lot of things, all doing to do with the world. And he at one point also did a master's degree, but it was quite a different situation. He did it in Paris, France. And, he was pretty young then, I think 26 or so. And it was not a one-year program, not a two-year. It was about close to 2 years, though. Very expensive, but he saved up enough money to pay for it. It was considered the outstanding MBA anywhere in the world for anybody doing anything. There are Russian students, Korean, they're from all over the world. Held at Roissy, you know where Roissy is, south of Paris. As soon as he got his degree, right away, he was captured, so to speak, by United Nations. That was a long time ago. Now Eric is very, very senior. 3,000 people work for him. I mean, he'd say that's not true. But anyway, there's a lot of politics. Eric hates politics. He's an electrical engineer, as is my youngest son, Josh. These are incredible people. And now I'm going to sing a song or two that might accentuate the positive of the first one. Song by Johnny Mercer. But we did it as part of our choir. There's an introduction for it. Gather round me, everybody. Gather round me while I testify. I feel a sermon coming on me, and the topic will be sin. That's what I'm again. If you want to hear my story, then just chill out, don't be uptight, while I review the attitude of doing right. You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. Latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum. Bring gloom down to that minimum. Have faith or pandemonium. Liable to walk up on the scene. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do when everything looked so dark? Woo! We better accentuate the positive. Eliminate the negative. Latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No! Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do when everything looked so dark? And they said, we better accentuate the positive. Eliminate the negative. Latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess Mr. In-Between. Oh, no! Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. Now, what is that anyway, Mr. In-Between? Well, I think it means you're not negative, that's pretty simple. Not positive, that's pretty simple. You're somewhere in between. Now, they're negative or positive or whatever. These Mr. In-Between people, Jesus, they sometimes go in all sorts of ways. Sometimes they're good ways, but quite often they're also bad ways. In other words, all sorts of ways. At least if somebody's negative, you know they're negative. Somebody's positive, you know they're positive. That's about my feeling about that song. Now, I did mention Josh, and I didn't mention very much about any of my daughters, my daughters-in-law, but whatever. I mentioned Naomi just before and what she went through. But what did she do? What did Naomi do? Was she a Hausfrau? Hausfrau? Not exactly. I don't think you'd call Naomi a Hausfrau. Not if you knew Naomi. She went to a Juilliard School of Art and Juilliard School of Manhattan of Art and Design. And something she was quite good at. That was when she was a kid. I mean, I don't know, 19, 20, 21, 22, whatever. Then she worked for something called Assure. I think that's what the name of it was. It was a woman's magazine. And she got to be design editor or something like that for 5 or 6 years. And then one day Naomi started, I don't know if she looked in the mirror, but she said to herself, I think I could do better on my own than she did. The house they lived in, which they first rented and then bought eventually, house they lived in was her office, so to speak. And the two children were brought up in that office with the help of a nanny, who was quite a wonderful nanny, because I saw quite a bit of her when I came to visit. I always use this as an example. Phone call comes during her office hours, 9 to 5. And it's Vanity Fair calling, Naomi. Could you do us a two-page spread? It'd be about $250,000. It's for this perfume organization. You know what I'm talking about. You got only 2 weeks, though. 2 weeks. And Naomi said, I can do it. She doesn't actually do it. She just organized it. But she does it. The last thing I'm going to do at the very end is not a nice poem. Not a song at all. It's not a nice poem. I don't know how many of you know about the Iraq War. Longest war I think ever fought. The last 100 years or so. And there's a town called, a small city actually, it was called Faliya. And about 300,000 people lived in it. They were called the insurgents, i.e. the Americans regarded them as the enemy, the insurgents. Though actually, this was their city. This is where they'd always lived. The Americans surrounded the city, gave them 24 hours to leave, or the city would then be destroyed. This is the poem. I call it Faliya, Faliya. It'll be my last poem. People go to war tonight. Most have left the city, except the insurgents. But who are they? Describe them for me. Are any of them women? Undoubtedly so. And children? Yes! Again, yes! 10-year-olds can hold a rifle, fire it, and die in the hands of a 17-year-old Reserve Army private, American, and black-skinned Dijon for pay, for money, for his mum, who is hungry a lot of the time. Now he is killing a little 10-year-old girl who is trying to kill him. Christ, what has become of us? Christ, what has become of us? Thank you.
Jacques Etou is at a crossroads in his life. He's just retired from a long career teaching music. For the first time in his life, he can do nothing but compose. He's just finished a concerto for organ and orchestra, and he's already thinking about another. It'll probably be a triple concerto for piano, violin, and cello. Beyond that, the waiting list extends to 12 commissions, several years' worth. Etou is one of Canada's most successful composers. Yet there was a time when he was a